From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, this morning, we first speak with Walt Meyer. He's a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado. Arctic sea ice reached its yearly minimum back in early September, and Walt will explain how much sea ice melted during this past summer, how that compares with previous summers, and how the sea ice is recovering over these past 5 weeks.
Then in the second part of the show, I speak with Rhonda Carnegie, executive director and founder of Project Dandelion. This is an organization calling on the women of the world to unite for a climate-safe world. We discuss the organization's mission and goals and its campaign to promote and support women with smallholder farms. All that and more today on This Green Earth. Stay with us. Today, we have special guest Walt Meyer, who is a senior scientist with National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado. Welcome, Walt.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Hey, Walt, we always appreciate you taking the time to chat with us every couple of times a year, right? When the Arctic sea ice reaches its maximum sometime around March and its minimum, so to speak, sometime in September. So you're here to, among other things, give us a little briefing on how this past summer up in the Arctic went with respect to sea ice. And so how did it fare?
Well, it was around the new normal, which means very low compared to the historical record. But not record breaking, not shocking or anything like that. In light of the recent years, it was the 10th lowest of our 47 year record now that started in 1979, and so it doesn't seem as extreme. But that 10th lowest is part of 19 years now that have been the 19th lowest in the satellite record. So starting in 2007, we've been below anything before that. So we've really are in a state of decreased ice cover year after year. We haven't seen a dramatic decline yet again, but we're not seeing any kind of recovery.
So 10th lowest, what are the lowest years, say the top three lowest years?
Yeah, so the lowest by a fair amount right now is 2012. And then the second lowest was 2007, 2016 and 2020 are all kind of in the same range there, right around tied with each other. So, you know, we've had several low years, but we haven't reached the 2012 level since then.
Interesting. Just to repeat, you say that the 19 lowest years have all occurred in the last 19 years. So that sounds like a new normal being set up.
Yeah. You know, there's actually been a couple papers this past summer that were published that looked at this, and it's what they're calling it is kind of a regime shift where we've gone from higher ice cover and thicker ice to a state where it's lower ice cover, but at least for now, relatively stable, but thinner. And the ice remaining is in the far north by the North Pole, north of Greenland, which is in an area that is less likely to melt. So we've kind of melted, in a sense, we've kind of melted the easy ice to melt. Now we're getting to the harder ice to melt, and we haven't had temperatures warm. We haven't had an extreme enough summer yet to really bite into that too much.
Yeah, so I was curious about this past summer. Are there parts of the Arctic that are consistently melting on a uniform basis more than other parts?
We've seen really a lot of melting off the coast of Alaska, the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea, the north and northwest coast of Alaska. That's been regularly opening up year after year. You would always have the ice pull away from the coast a bit, maybe 100 kilometers, 100 miles or so. But now it's going out like 1,000 miles. It's pulling away much farther. And then on the east side, on the Atlantic side, in the Barents Sea and the Kara Sea, which is like north of Scandinavia, north of Western Russia, that's really been open and opening up regularly. So kind of on both sides of the Arctic. And really, when we look at kind of the long-term trends, everywhere around the Arctic is losing ice, wherever there is variability. But the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas have been particularly notable for the loss of ice and the early loss of ice in the season.
Is that a function of water temperature? Is it a function of air temperature? Talk a little bit about the priorities there or the major impacts there.
Yeah, and it's a function, I would say, of both. I mean, certainly air temperatures are rising, but there is also a lot of heat that has been accumulated in the ocean. What happens normally north of Alaska is you have something called the Beaufort Gyre. A gyre is just a spinning circulation pattern. It's clockwise. And what would typically happen is the ice would spin around there. There wouldn't be enough warmth to melt it out. So the ice would spin around and survive through the summer and get thicker and thicker, up to maybe 12 or 15 feet thick even. But what we've seen is there's now so much heat in the ocean as well as in the atmosphere that the ice is spinning into that gyre north of Alaska. It's encountering this heat and it's melting. So it used to be kind of a nursery for older and thicker ice, the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. And it's become kind of a graveyard. We're just not seeing that ice survive. And so the Beaufort, particularly in Chukchi, are opening up, and then it's not circulating back around to continue aging. So we're seeing a much younger, and that means thinner ice cover.
Yeah, so younger, thinner. What are we talking about when you say thinner ice up there?
Yeah, so ice in a winter, in a given winter, if it starts growing right at the beginning of the season, like, you know, September, early October, grows through the winter into March, April, May, it will get to be about 2 meters thick, about 6.5 feet thick. If it survives the summer and thickens, it keeps thickening over the subsequent years, and then it gets to be like 12 to 15 feet thick, about 3 to 4 meters thick. So it's a huge difference in the ice cover that survives through the summer melt season versus the ice cover that melts away each summer. So we used to have the Arctic dominated by ice that would stay around for several years, 5, 6, 7, even 10 years, some of it. And now most of that ice is gone. Now most of it is this ice that's what we call first year ice that's grown just since the previous summer. And even ice that survives that summer and grows and continues to grow in a subsequent winter, it's only lasting generally 2 or 3 years instead of surviving for 6 or 7 or even more years.
Interesting. And again, this is based on some 40 some years of data collection. And so now you're saying that there used to be year over year or older, quote unquote, older ice back in the 80s and maybe in the 90s, but basically those days are gone?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the only place we see that ice surviving is north of Greenland, kind of a strip from Greenland and the Canadian archipelago, the islands on the north end of Canada, up to like the North Pole. You might get some of it kind of spilling out into other areas a little bit from, you know, from in various places different from year to year, but by far, the vast majority of what's left is in that really pretty small corridor north of Greenland and by the North Pole.
Wow.
I know that we have asked you this before about how you calculate this. What does the mechanics of that look like and what kind of instruments do you use? But I am curious, because we are moving at such a rapid rate in technology, have you seen some technological changes in how you receive this data, and how has that helped, or how has that moved forward?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely seen improvements in sensors and kind of like just the same type of sensors, but they're getting better. We get better resolution, we can see more detail, but we also are getting new sensors and more new sensors that's really allowing us to see even different things. For example, This was now 7 years ago, but NASA launched what's called the Ice Cloud and Land Elevation Satellite 2, or ICESat 2. That's a laser altimeter, as we call it. It sends out photons, laser photons, visible light photons that bounce off the surface and then come back. And we know the speed of light, so we know how fast they're moving, and we can measure the time. So that tells us the elevation and how high the ice is above like the water surface. And from that, we can estimate the thickness. So we actually can get thickness directly measured, which is something that we couldn't do before. We had ICESat 2, and then there was also a radar, which uses radar signals from a sensor called Cryosat 2, which the Europeans launched back in 2010. So between those two, we now have pretty good estimates of thickness, which we didn't have. Now, the age, which I talked about, that we could do by tracking the ice, and we've had that technology for a long time, but we've been able to get better at it over time. And so we can connect that age with the thickness. Like I said, older ice is thicker ice. So we are getting a more detailed and more complete picture of the ice cover with new technologies.
And
we're, let me reintroduce Walt. We're speaking with Walt Meyer. He's a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado.
And I know we're talking about technology here, so I think that humans, as we move forward with technology, it's really interesting for the knowledge gathering and the understanding, but sometimes we try to utilize that to make changes too. And I've been hearing some stories about, I think it's, there's a Dutch system that is going out there and working on different technologies to try to thicken the ice. And there are different ways in which they are looking to have human involvement, I guess, with technologies. How do you feel about that? Because I feel like every time that happens and you shift something that's happening naturally, then on the back end of that, it could change our weather systems. It could affect things that, you know, maybe we don't know the domino effect.
Yeah. This is what's called geoengineering. Basically trying to slow down or reverse the effects of global warming. And you mentioned going out and putting things on the ice to kind of keep the ice from melting or helping it regrow. I'm not sure if this is the exact company that you're thinking of, but there's been one where basically they put out pumps that will pump seawater from beneath the ice on top of it, which then refreezes and then will thicken the ice. And I'm quite skeptical of those. And I think most, if not nearly all of the climate science community is very skeptical and very wary of these. First of all, it's not hard to put these out, this idea out in theory, but in practice, it's really a challenge that I don't know if they really respect. The Arctic sea ice, even as low as it is, covers, several million miles. So what are you going to do to, what is it going to take to keep that ice thicker? And then, like you say, there's the unforeseen consequences. What happens when you put all these pumps out in the Arctic or other things? What are the other environmental consequences? There was an idea of putting out like glass beads that would be more reflective and keep the ice from melting as much. But now you've got glass beads in the environment. What happens when seals and other animals and polar bears eat these? So I'm very wary of these.
Yeah, I think that is a wise thing to be wary of, because the after effects can cause, I think, probably a whole slew of problems that we can't foresee that could be even more damaging for us in the long run.
Exactly. In my view, and I think, again, the consensus among scientists, the most effective way to kind of preserve the sea ice is to slow down warming, is to try to reduce carbon emissions, mm-hmm. Reduce greenhouse gases, and keep the climate from getting as warm as it's heading towards, and maybe even try to start cooling it at some point. That's the most effective way. The ice will grow back pretty quickly when the temperatures are cooler. And so that's really the most effective way, in my view, to bring back the ice cover.
Well, let's turn towards our attention to that. I think sea ice minimum day or so, quote unquote, was around September 10th. Is that correct?
Yes.
This year.
It's always in September. Yeah.
It's always in September around that time, plus or minus.
Yeah.
Since then, of course, we're now in the middle of fall, head of the winter. How is sea ice recovering?
So it's recovering kind of along normal lines. I mean, it's still quite low. It's been somewhat rapid recently in the last week or so. That's not too surprising. And it's still well below normal. It's actually tracking along 2012 levels, which was the record low minimum. So 2012 had a little bit faster freeze up. And that's kind of what we expect to see. There is this what we call a negative feedback that it kind of attenuates the loss of ice to some extent, potentially, in that when you have the ocean exposed and there's a lot of heat in that ocean that accumulates over the summer. So the ice might grow back slower initially. But then once the ocean loses its heat to the atmosphere, the sun is down. So the atmosphere is very cold. So you could actually grow ice quite rapidly once the ocean hits the freezing point. So we see this kind of regular catching up of the ice cover in the fall and into the winter. Now, where we're looking now, for example, in that Siberian area, like in the what's called the Barents and Kara Seas, that's still got a lot of open water. That's an indication that there's still a lot of ocean heat there that's preventing ice from reforming. But like the Beaufort Sea has mostly filled in now. So the ice is getting close to the coast of Alaska now.
Well, speaking of open water, this might be a little bit off your track or purview, but shipping, continue to see the trend in shipping using the Arctic routes during the summer, late summer months?
Yeah, we are definitely seeing that on the Russian coastline, what's called the Northern Sea Route or the Northeast Passage that goes along the coast of Siberia. That's contrast with what's called, which is the more famous and more well-known, the Northwest Passage, which goes through the Canadian archipelago, through the Canadian islands. That was kind of the long time, sought after passage. That always is a bit troublesome because the ice flows in from, there's winds and currents that kind of push the ice in there. So it can be hard to clear out even when it's warm. But the Siberian side, the ice tends to get pushed away from the coast. So we are regularly seeing that open up now. Now, the Russians also have icebreakers, so they can kind of open that up even if there is ice there. So there's a little bit of, there certainly is the climate change and the warming and the loss of ice is helping out, but also the Russians see that as an economically viable passage, and they're helping to keep that open. And they control that passage, basically. So they can charge ships for icebreaker escorts and to go through their waters. So there's incentive for the Russians to do that regardless, and that's increasing. But the warming and the loss of ice is certainly helping that.
Right, and of course this is an option too. That's those same ships going south all the way through the Panama Canal and then back up if they're going to say Europe or Eastern U.S. or North America. So that's I'm sure lots of countries over in Asia are doing their math to determine, is it worth the toll to pay Russia to get escorted through their waters?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, that's definitely increasing. What's kind of interesting is if the ice cover continues to decrease and retreats far enough, you could potentially have the cross-polar route, which goes, straight across the North Pole. That's international waters. And so then you don't need the Russians permission or guidance, and you don't have to pay them. We're not at that point yet. I mean, we've come pretty close to the pole. As the Arctic continues to warm, we are looking at, an Arctic that's essentially ice-free in the summertime, at least for a period of time, by probably mid-century. Very likely by mid-century and possibly before. So that pole route will be opening up in the coming years.
Oh, okay. And I remember, Walt, we've had conversations for, 10, 12 years. And when we would get around to that, you know, when would the pole be ice-free? Maybe 12 years ago or 15 years ago, it was somewhere around 2080 or 2075. It seems to be accelerating, getting closer and closer to our, mine and yours, lifetime, right?
Yeah, definitely. There was a recent paper a few months ago that looked at, did some modeling studies based on, how trends are going and what the warming is going to be. And if we continue kind of on the current trajectory, there's some simulations, it's not a great chance, but it could potentially happen as early as 2030. I think that's pretty unlikely. But like I said, by 2050, you start to get very likely. It used to be 2070, 2080, 2100. This was, I've said, when we initially started looking at this was something that maybe my children or grandchildren might see in their lifetimes.
Right.
And now I'm 56 years old. If I live a decent life, I'm very likely to see that in my lifetime, which I would have thought 15 years ago.
Or wished for,
isn't right. And if we talk about the impacts of this, let's go over some of these global impacts for our ocean, for marine life, and what it could mean also for our weather patterns.
Yeah. The ice cover is reflective. It's white. And so it reflects most of the sun's energy. And it helps keep the Arctic cool. And it also keeps the planet cool. It's like an air conditioner for the planet. And as we lose the ice, the ocean absorbs over 90% of the sun's energy, and the ocean heats up. That melts more ice, but it also warms the atmosphere. It keeps the atmosphere warm into the fall and winter. And when you change that balance in the Arctic versus the mid-latitudes, like where we live, that changes the weather patterns, things like the jet stream that kind of control the flow of our weather systems. And there's still controversy about this in terms of, are we seeing an effect yet? There's some that say, yes, we are. There's some that are saying, no, we aren't. There's a lot of extreme weather that we've seen that are linked to this kind of the jet stream slowing down, getting wavier, which is a pattern we expect to see with the loss of ice and the warming in the Arctic. But extreme events are by their nature rare. And so it can be hard to kind of really link those up. We don't have as much data as we would like to do that. But when you're taking something the size of like the lower 48 United States and changing it from a white surface to a dark surface, which is essentially what we're doing with the loss of ice, that's a huge change. And it's definitely going to have implications for the weather patterns. And then also for the ocean, of course, the ice is floating on the ocean. As you change the ice cover, the ocean is going to respond as well.
Last couple minutes, you mentioned that, a lot of the work that you do and it's done here in the U.S. is through NASA or NOAA or so, among other groups. We know there's funding challenges associated with some of that. Are other countries, do other countries collect data that we can, that what they will share with us or we share with them?
Yeah. The U.S. has always been kind of the leading the group, leading the world in open data and having the data be open. NASA data, NOAA data has been free and open for years and years and years. Other countries have been less open, but that has really changed. The Europeans have allowed access, and the Japanese. We actually, our U.S. data, there's the satellite sensors have gotten old. They're starting to be decommissioned, actually, or in planning to be. So we've actually switched, and we're now using Japanese sensors to track the ice cover because they're newer and they're this time they're more reliable. And we get that data for free, no problems at all. There are some countries, China, Russia, are still very protective and of their data, not very accessible. But there's a lot of data that's accessible. India and NASA just launched a joint venture, a satellite that's going to help not so much for the Arctic, but particularly for the Antarctic. It's a radar system that's really going to be getting a lot of data. And so there's a lot of international collaboration that goes on, both in terms of missions and data.
That's encouraging, Walt.
Yeah.
And we will do our best to leave it on an encouraging note. Walt Meyer, a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado. Walt, the website for people to go to learn more about your work, the Arctic, and as we always forget, the Antarctic, or not forget.
Yeah.
Research there too.
Yep. It's nsidc.org. Just the initials of National Snow and Ice Data Center.org.
Perfect.
Well, Walt, thank you so much for joining us again, and we appreciate you. I hope sometime that we will have better news to share, but it sounds like these are the trends that we are facing, and it helps to be knowledgeable about what is going on. So we appreciate you doing that for us here on This Green Earth.
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me. I always enjoy talking to you.
We'll see you in March.
Yeah, sounds great.
Yes, we'll talk to you in March. Thanks, Walt. And right now, we have the special honor of having with us today Rhonda Carnegie, who is the co-founder and executive director for Project Dandelion. This is an organization calling on the women of the world to unite for a climate-safe world. Rhonda, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan.
Well, fantastic. Well, that's so great to hear. I want to get started first because we do love to get a background on our guests and who you are. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what brought you to Project Dandelion?
Absolutely. Well, I think before this, I spent years at the TED Talk brand, and I was part of the leadership team that actually built that brand from a single conference into a media brand. This is just all to tell you a little bit about how my brain is wired. I really believe in the power of ideas that are powerful enough to change the way we see the world. And I spent over 8 years there traveling the world and meeting just amazing people that were part of that work. And that work has really led me to my work with Project Dandelion.
I love that you have this symbol of a dandelion. Is there a specific reason that you chose that to be part of your branding and your name?
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you asked the question about symbols, especially since, you know, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and you see people wearing the symbol of the pink ribbon. And when you see someone wearing a pink ribbon, you know that it's a reminder for a couple of things. You know, it's a reminder that you want to be in solidarity with those who have breast cancer. You are working to help find a cure. You are investing in research. And certainly, you are focused on taking care of yourself. And we see it very similar with the nature and climate crisis. And so we came up with the symbol of the dandelion. For those of your listeners who know, some people call a dandelion a flower. Others call it a weed. The thing we know about the dandelion is you can't get rid of it. It's also of nature, and every part of it is regenerative and medicinal. So, you know, I get all the time people send me dandelion tea or all sorts of iterations of the dandelion. But the interesting thing about the dandelion is that it really focuses on everyone's wayfinding into creating a climate-safe world that is livable for all. And it's an invitation for people to be a part of what that solution looks like. So Project Dandelion and its symbol is really built on this experience about how do we use storytelling, telling our personal stories to connect and amplify those who are designing climate solutions and those who are leading change within their communities.
You mentioned sharing people's journeys or stories. I think that that is such a great point of connection with people, and with your background with TED, it's all about that human connection and collaboration. And collaboration seems to be a big part of how your organization was formed and how you operate. When I think about collaboration, I think of an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I want to hear your take on the importance of
partnerships or collaboration and how that plays out in your organization?
Well, first of all, that is one of our favorite quotes. So thank you for bringing it forward. And just even your own program, the Green Earth, the fact that you are looking at the subject from science or politics or economics or ethics of the environment. It's all to say that all of these elements really need to work together in partnership. And that is about, as you had said, like, what can we learn from all of these various individuals that are in these various areas? So we say at Project Dandelion, when it comes to partnership, we're looking to connect, to mobilize, and amplify. And the connect piece of it is that collective action. How are we standing together to really be able to partner with others who have great solutions? In other words, we believe the solutions are all out there. It's just a matter of connecting the dots. And we have just found in the climate movement in general that it's been so fragmented. Everyone so holds on to what they think their solution is, that we need to spend more time making the connection between climate and health. And it's not just when we say health, it's not in very technical terms. It's the air we breathe, the food we eat, the heat we're feeling. Like, it, we really have to humanize this. And so much of partnership is finding those various ways to connect. And then how are we working together to mobilize? And then how are we amplifying the work of great innovation that's happening on the front line that points us to such a powerful way forward?
Yes, I think power in the collaboration and power in how we see the world and collectively coming together around these initiatives and understanding the importance behind them and the ripple effect of them. And I think it's really interesting. I looked through your website and you bring to the table some really big initiatives. You label them as demands. I think it's important to say that it's okay for us to demand better. It's okay for us to say, no, these are our intrinsic rights as human beings to be able to demand these things. And some of these are pay up to those least responsible but most impactive, shift and incentivize investment to renewables. You've got scale a fair and accessible energy future, and you've also got learn from Indigenous people. There's such a power to learning from people who have been in these communities or been a part of this land far before many of us and have learned to live with the land and to have a reverence for it. Why did you put that in there about learning from Indigenous peoples?
You know, so much a part of when we were building Project Dandelion, and I think that this is something that all organizations think about. When we think about who is the we in this, it's really important to be able to include that when we say we are Project Dandelion, that is also is our Indigenous sisters who are really leading the way. They are so close to nature. They are the guardians of our forest. They bring value to every living thing, whether it be plant or animal. They understand the changing of what they're seeing on their land and out in the world. And they believe, and we believe too, that if we can solve for this, the best of time is ahead of us. And so we learned so much from our Indigenous sisters. You know, we all believe in the power of the written word. In many ways, they are amazing storytellers who bring us, as you had shared, just this incredible wisdom that nature teaches us. And we feel that there are so many answers in nature, and our Indigenous sisters really bring us closer to what that looks like.
We often talk about this on the show here about learning from how the land was treated prior to really when there was such divides or separations, or this is my land, this is your land, and those divisions. But when we're all working together, the land will regenerate itself when we take down some of these barriers or lines and decide that we're all in this together. We all prosper. And I love that you put the we in that, because there is so much separation, I feel like, in our world now. Why do you think it's important that there is a collective we?
Yeah, I think it goes back to human language. You know, I think that that's one of the things that we've seen in the world right now. Like, there are certain words, like when you had said demands are a very strong word, maybe they are a very strong word. You know, that we're all very reactive to words right now. And I think that it's important during this time to find that when we all say we are looking for a climate safe or a climate smart world that is livable for all, that we're talking about a heart language, a human language. We're really taking this, understanding what the needs of the populations are, but also really understanding that, you know, our Indigenous sisters also talk to us, our Indigenous community also talk to us about the abundance that nature delivers us. You know, I was at dinner with someone the other day, and they said, this is a great restaurant. It's farm to table. And we both sort of laughed. We're like, isn't everything farm to table? Like, you know, we just have to understand where things come from, where our food systems come from where we see when we are able to be able to enjoy Mother Nature. And I think that, we're not there. I think we've lost the plot a little bit. We've got to get back to finding that language that we believe is zero partisan and one in which we're all working together.
Yeah. And one of your campaigns that has recently come out does really delve into farmers and what is important as these small farmers throughout our world are trying to produce these crops and trying to feed their communities. And I'm intrigued by this campaign around women smallholder farms. Can you walk us through this? Give us a description of what is meant by a smallholder farmer and an example of some of these women farmers around the world and their stories.
Yeah, well, let me introduce you to some of these stories, because I think in the stories, it tells you a little bit about what we are seeing when we think about smallholder farmers. First of all, we found, like, even the name itself, by calling them smallholder farmers, it makes you think, like, these are people who've got, like, a farm in their backyard, you know? So just even, again, going back to the idea of language. But let's go to Ethiopia, for example, where women have been leading just local irrigation associations, a role that was once only reserved for men. And in just a few years, what we found is that when the men were in charge, they were creating the irrigation, so it only went to their own farms. And when women took it over, just in a few years, when they redid the irrigation systems, women now make up a quarter of those in leadership positions. Water access has been improved, crops has thrived, and food security has been strengthened. And now they're getting three times the yield that they once were by this innovation. So one of the things we wanted to show is where innovation is happening, where women are embedded into the solution. And it's a simple and a profound truth. What we found in Ethiopia, that when women lead, communities prosper, and they're part of a family unit. So they do it as part of a family unit. And in that way, like, really understanding the cultural ramifications of that, I'm really looking at them as entrepreneurs. When we think about them, not just as smallholder farmers, but as women entrepreneurs, we think about that in a different way. And so, you know, we think here when women lead, you know, the water is more powerful and the harvest gets stronger. The second story brings us to India, where often we find women are given barren land that nobody wants. And in this case, these women were able to take this barren land and to create an incredible bamboo farm and be able to, again, show economic livelihood. They were able to prosper, and the output of what they are creating are cutting boards that are sold in IKEA. So you don't, you know, in the past when we looked at women smallholder farmers. We saw pictures of them in a field so graciously, you know, thanking them, like as if they need aid. And in essence, that's not the case. They are breaking through and they are innovating. They are dealing with incredibly tough situations and they are thriving. So what we know is when we just look at women smallholder farmers, the numbers are astounding. They produce 70% of Africa's food, and yet they are only receiving less than 1% of global climate finance. So we feel like that's not only, you know, sort of ridiculous, but it's also economically irrational. And if we close the gap on this in agriculture alone, in small and medium income countries alone, we will be able to add to the global GDP $1 trillion. So it's amazing to try to or to showcase this kind of stories that say when women farmers have access to land, when they have access to finance and decision making, that the whole community becomes resilient. And that's why our campaign is, its tagline is invest when the where the impact is greatest. And women smallholder farmers are anything but small.
I love those stories. And I love the idea of being able to put more resources behind something that is already proving to be successful and understanding what that means for the bottom line for all of us and how that helps the world as a whole. And it gets back into that if we look at these women and these countries who are moving forward and like you said, under some of these circumstances that are hard, there are a lot of obstacles, but they're pushing through those obstacles and they're creating these very viable situations. And they're just, they're not asking actually for much. It's not at all a hand out, but it's really a hand up to help us all.
Yeah, no, I think that's so well said. And I think what we want to do with this campaign is to call people in, and in a number of ways. One, when you share these stories, there's just, you share these stories and you're like, wow, this is incredible to know that these kinds of stories are going on. But we're finding from partner organizations around the world, it's giving them a chance to tell their own story. So if you are an organization in India like Sewa, who is a self-employed women's association that represents 3.2 million rural women, that for them, they can use this campaign to tell their story of innovation. So it's like, here's one story, but this is what we're doing. In addition, it allows 3.2 million people, and this is just one example of women who are on the ground in India to say, we stand with smallholder farmers, and we also stand in solidarity to push for more capital to mobilize these and to have their voices be heard. And as you travel to places like India and you meet these women, for them to be a part of a global dialogue and have their voices be heard is just incredible.
And what are your hopes then as you push this campaign forward? What is it that you would really like to see happen as a result?
Well, we know two things. One, we know that we are getting ready for the big climate negotiations in Brazil. It's called COP30. This is the big, for your listeners who may not know, maybe many of them do know, but this is where the world will be looking to solutions. And certainly it's being held in the global south. So they'll be looking. And climate finance is on the agenda. So we try to find a moment where we can both play an inside game where policymakers are coming together and those who are helping to make decisions about regulation, about some of these important policies are coming together. And certainly climate finance people will be there. And we are, again, calling in to be able to say, here's an opportunity to create $3 trillion into GDP. And we are pushing for more financing going to smallholder farmers for what they need. So we will use that as a moment for the climate negotiations to be able to highlight that. We have a widget, which is part of our campaign, and we will be talking about those who are investing in this area and calling for more development banks and others to also invest in that area. So we'll use that. That's what we call the inside game. And then for us on the outside, we want to really, again, bring more people off the sidelines to be able to learn more about the stories of smallholder farmers and participate in this pressure opportunity in order to move capital where we think it can make the most impact.
Well, your background and what you have done with TED probably really lends itself to understanding what resonates with people and how we can come together around a subject.
Yeah, I think I'm insatiably curious. Like, I have lots of questions. We all have a lot of questions about where we're going, what's happening, what does collective action mean? I often, people say, well, what exactly can I do? And there's so many things that people are wanting to do. They're not sure of their way in. We know collective action is one piece of it. But just having, you know, a lot of awareness about where your food is coming from, what we're putting into our bodies, and certainly how we're creating a world for future generations, and just being curious about it is an important part of what this work is.
And we've been thinking global and talking global here, but I have heard you say that you also have to think local and global. So do you have some actions that maybe myself or our listeners locally could do?
Well, first of all, join us on getting more information. We invite you to go to projectdandelion.com, and we have a newsletter called the Dandelion Digest, where we highlight these stories of just incredible work going on locally and globally, and we update you on sort of what we're seeing, what the news is saying, what the perspectives are on different ways to get involved. I also want to say that this campaign is really a door opener to 2026, which actually, I love that the UN has come up that is going to be the year of the women farmer. So this is a great opportunity. And right now, here we are in October, we are right during harvest season. We're getting ready for Thanksgiving and some of these other holidays where we will be enjoying food together as a family, or we will be bringing food to others who are in need. Make that connection between the wonderful things we get, again, like I said, farm to table, really understanding where our food comes from, and be a part of that conversation about food. And you can join in this by sharing with us what you would like Project Dandelion to do to help you have a better understanding of food systems and where that is at the intersection of what you're seeing in your own community.
I am really thrilled to have you on this green earth and to have been able to have the opportunity to hear from you and some of the initiatives that Project Dandelion is putting forth. And we should all understand where our food comes from. We should all understand what's happening globally with the farmers. And we should take a closer look at how our money is being spent in the federal level, the local level, in our governments, and is it being spent wisely, and do we have a voice? And I think that Project Dandelion is saying that we do have a voice.
Exactly. We do have a voice. And thank you so much for just having me here on the show. And again, just a huge invitation to your listeners to share with us where they're seeing great programs happening. We're hearing just even in the United States, some great programs on nutrition in schools, and really thinking about, again, where that food is coming from and how to move that forward. So share with us where things are working, what you want to know more about, and we would love to make the connections to those who are in our network to get you that information.
And can we give that website one more time if people want to learn more about your organization?
Yes, come to us at projectdandelion.com, and I encourage you to subscribe to the Dandelion Digest. We are now just 2 years old, so you're seeing a sneak peek into where we are going, and the we is really all of us. So watch this space and also be a dandelion, become a dandelion.
Well, thank you so much. We have been speaking with Rhonda Carnegie, who is the executive director and co-founder of Project Dandelion. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.